Welcome to the Wealth Building Made Simple podcast with Philip Washington Jr. Today's episode is brought to you by StonehillWealthManagement.com. Today, Philip talks about currency trading. Philip Washington Jr. is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and/or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. Past performance is not indicative of future performance. And now, here's Philip.
We are back with another episode of Wealth Building Made Simple, brought to you by StonehillWealthManagement.com, my wealth management firm where we help people bring their money into the future over and above the inflation hurdle is the goal. Also brought to you and produced by Podcast Mansfield, the dopest podcast production studio on the planet. But if you live in the DFW marketplace, come through. They do editing. They got on-site production, whatever you need, custom-made from a veteran radio producer that transferred to the new age. You just don't get that these days. You get the new stuff. Right, and that's cool, and they're good, but when you can blend the old and the new, I call that heaven, and that's what Steve and his team are. They are heaven. Podcast Mansfield. Let's get into currency trading today. Before we go there, I do want to give a very simple idea. This is completely separate to the topic, but I think it's important for the listeners. It's what I call buy, maintain, and enjoy, right? And what I mean by that. One of the financial planning considerations that I feel like very few of us take into account, like I know I didn't, not until recently, is the maintenance cost of owning things, right? Maintenance cost of owning a home, maintenance cost of owning a car, right? And it's thought I've been thinking about, and I even listened to a podcast 2 days ago where the very rich guy was talking about like the maintenance cost of, like he factors in, if he buys a yacht, he factors in a 10% a year maintenance cost to pay for it. And like, you think about, especially if you're a homeowner, you think about it's supposed to be a pleasurable experience. But, you know, for a lot of us, it's stressful because you get all these expenses, right? And when you step back, you go, oh, these are things that I knew were going to come, but it wasn't built into the budget of the purchase of the home or the car, like to really maintain it and keep it the way you want it. And so it's easy to buy things, right? Maintaining is the tough part. And then by maintaining and enjoying it is what you want to do. And so it goes back to one of my favorite Jay-Z quotes, you know, only buy one of something if you can buy two. And what that means is, when you're thinking about adding expenses or when you're building your budget, I mean, I think it's just super useful to maybe put 10-20% as a line item in your budget for just maintenance costs. If you just off the bat put 10-20% of what you make in your budget for maintenance around your lifestyle, then those surprises like won't set you back. It just becomes an expense, right? If you don't spend it, it stays into your, you know, cash account, right? But it will also limit the, you may end up initially buying a smaller home, a smaller car, but it will be a more enjoyable process because it'll force you to be wiser about your purchases, right? And it'll actually allow you to enjoy it because you'll be able to maintain it and keep it beautiful, right? Now, separate aside, if your joy is tied up in the size of your home or the make or model of your car, then you got to work on that emotional problem first. But this will help. This will, this idea probably for me is the best budgeting strategy that you can incorporate into your plan that just you know, a lot of us don't think about. So putting that idea there, take it or throw it out, whatever you want to do. But let's move to the regular show. So everything is a currency trade, right? Everything is a currency trade. Think of currency as like the current that moves the weather around the earth, right? Meaning like if you really want to nerd out, you get like these you get like the spiraling of the earth, right? And that spiraling creates sort of a wind vortex that sort of helps the water move around the earth. And I won't go super nerd on you, but think of it as like you got the earth and then you got the spiral and then you got the current that like affects the weather patterns, you know, of the earth, right? So currency is that to an economy, right? Currency affects all asset prices tied to that economy. So dollar, right? Everything in the dollar-based system is just, it's a derivative of dollars, right? So people want to own real estate because they want to own income-producing assets, which are like dollar-producing assets. If you buy a stock in a company, you want dividends or something that's going to produce dollars. If you want, or even if it doesn't pay dividends, then you want like appreciation, meaning if you buy a company that's worth $1 million and you think over the next decade it's going to be worth $3 million, right? Then you're saying, I want to add $2 million of dollars, right, to my balance sheet over time. And so all assets valuations are tied to that currency. And so and so all assets move on these relative currency expectations, right? And so if you're thinking about trading, right? I was talking to a guy who owns a business who he got into currency trading. And I was telling him this, and I was like, listen, like, you can try to trade the short term, and that's cool. Do what you want to do. But I would recommend you understand the game you're playing, because if you're trading currencies or any assets and you're doing it on a short-term base, like a day trader, right, then you got to say, all right, what money am I trying to make, right? What value am I bringing to market? Well, short-term traders are bringing liquidity, right? They're the ones that make money in the bid-ask spread, right, the gap. And so it's processing information very fast. Well, the liquidity today, the best liquidity providers are going to be like artificial intelligence, right? These automated trading systems. And when you're playing that game, it's sort of like trying to compete against a calculator doing math. I mean, maybe there's somebody on the planet that can do that because they've tapped into the quantum mind, right? And they can do it, right? I'm not saying like it's not possible. Like humans evolve our minds and we're pretty smarter than what we think. But I'm just saying it's probably an easier way to play that game. But so I said, you can go intermediate term or you can go long term, meaning like you can look for the big trade, right? And the big moves in currencies, which affects all markets, are when the expectations are changing. So think of I think I've said it multiple times, but think of the market as a collective mindset. And when the collective mindset or the collective perspective changes, it's sort of like imagine the mind as like this big sentient being, right? And wherever it puts its vision, life flourishes. But as it changes its vision, as it moves its vision along through time, the thing that it takes its vision off dies, and the thing that it places its vision on comes to life. And so as an investor, you're saying, oh, I know, I can see where the market's vision is moving towards. And so let me in advance, move towards that. And so the big moves, as I said, are made in noticing those changes in market expectations, right? And so what it looks like in the financial world is like liquidity. So you got like an ocean of money. And the ocean of money are managed by, you know, individuals, which is the smallest component, retail investors. But then you got wealth management firms, you got money management firms, you got hedge funds, you got sovereign wealth funds, right? You got corporations, you got governments, you got all this money. And all of us are individually making decisions on what's the best use of our money. And everybody wakes up to their understanding of like the market attention changing at our own pace, right? So the more forward-thinking, open-minded capital allocators see it first and position themselves. But the ocean of money, right, the largest pools of money, which are, they sort of have a slower reaction, right? You know, think of it, you know, they've saw the world one way for a long period of time. And if you see the world one way for a long period of time, it takes a while for your vision to adjust, right? I like to parallel it to, you know, some people think that as we get older, our vision deteriorates, right? I don't really believe that. I think it's the lack of taking care of your mental health, right? But that's a whole conversation. But that's just a belief. And so that's cool. The good thing is if you track the liquidity, if you track the big piles of money and you see the gap between where the new allocators are and the big pile of money are, and you know they're going to eventually get here because it's just right? They got money because they were great allocators. And the current generation of great allocators, which are like them with a more open mind, right? You see that gap and you go, oh, this is where the big money is made. And so I like to, as an investor, focus on like the big trade, which is like, all right, what is the today? What today is the reserve asset, right? What's the considered safe asset today based on the collective mind of the market? And then what is going to be the, because that reserve asset is like relatively scarce or the foundation of the financial system. And so what's that? And then what's the most scarce asset that exists today, but that's going to be more appreciated 10 years from now, right? And there's not just one asset, but there's multiple assets. So it's sort of like in non-nerd terms, it's like snapshot of the world today. How's the world look, right? And then you go 10 years from now, you jump in a mental time machine and you go, all right, what is the world like a decade from now? Based on like preferences that I understand people to have, and how does that look, and what is very valuable, very appreciated, that is a one of a kind thing. But I'm not really imagining new things. I'm saying I'm taking the pieces from the present, taking them into the future and sort of rearranging them, right? So I'm going, let me give you a real example. So I go, monetary systems. I go, okay, today the world has bought into storing value, a lot of value in a monetary system that is increasingly making the value of the money in it worth less and less to pay for all the debts. And let me go to the future, right? Do I think what's the trend of the debts? Meaning, is it getting worse or is it getting better? Well, the debts are getting better. The debts are getting worse. And the debt's getting worse, that means like the value of the current money in the system is going to probably go down even more, right? That's a reasonable logic, right? You can, if you want to test your logic, play with ChatGPT or Copilot and just put these something in there. Hey, if I have a currency and the finances of the government that backs the currency are getting worse, is it reasonable to expect them to be more worse in the future? It's going to be like very good logic, right? It's not like imagining out of thin air. That's like proper logic. So then you go, okay, what's the alternative, right? Is there another, because this is what currency traders do. When people are trading currencies, they're looking at different economic systems, different currency systems, different stores of value. And again, I interchange currencies with, I don't call, you know, Let me say this before I go in here. I call everything a currency, right? There's the bit currency, which is like the everything's derived off of, but real estate is a currency to me. Apple stock is a currency to me. ETFs are a currency to me. Bitcoin is a currency to me. It's a store of value currency, right? Maybe not the part of the currency we exchange, but when we're investing, we're talking about the store of value parts of currencies, right? So all those things are currencies. So let's go back. So I go, all right. So we have this currency. So I go, okay, people are going to be looking for more things to store their value in because the base reserve currency is going to become less and less. So 10 years from now, what does that mean? Well, to me, that means people are going to want to have more scarce real estate in their portfolio. People who have money, right? People who are buying assets. So where are those? Well, you can go look at where rich people live, right? They live on coasts, which is scarce. They go look, they live in economic centers, New York, LA, Tokyo, Paris, London, Dallas, in the hearts of the city, right? So I go, yeah, I probably want to own real estate there. And then you go, okay, where else do I want to own? Well, there's this, you know, gold is breaking all time highs, right? And that's a scarce resource. So maybe I want to own some gold. And then you go, hey, kid, tell me about this Bitcoin, right? What's this monetary system where it's only going to be 21 million and they can't print more of? Because it's getting bigger and bigger. I see the number going up relative to the dollar, right? It used to be like less than a dollar to buy one of these things. Now it's $70,000 to buy one of these things, right? This is super interesting. Tell me more about it, right? So you go, oh, yeah, it's a monetary system that can't be manipulated by a central authority. It's independent. It's sort of like Switzerland of the digital economy. And then you go, well, is the digital economy going to get bigger or smaller, right? It's going to get bigger. I mean, that's the virtual economy is the future. So then you go, and who are the wealth builders in a virtual economy? Well, it's people who are very tech savvy. Well, to tech savvy, you know, what is their asset base makeup? Well, the majority of them own Bitcoin. They don't question it or some sort of digital currency, but they all understand Bitcoin is the core of that financial system. So then you go, so it's sort of like a new economy that's being built that is not geographically limited. So it would be the equivalent of UK was the 1800s reserve currency country. America was the 1900s, and the 2000 is digital, which is not location dependent. Interesting, right? So this is me building a world, right? So I'm taking what's happening today. I'm rebuilding the world based on like principles that are always true. And I'm going, oh, okay. So yeah, like it's probably a good thing to own scarce real estate. It's probably a good thing to own some Bitcoins. It's probably a good thing to go, you go, oh, you got all these manufacturers that, right? Because if you want to be a country that's competitive and have an economy that's competitive, you got to manufacture things. And you have this narrative in America that America can't manufacture things because labor cost is too expensive. But then you go, well, what about Tesla? I mean, they just spun up a car company out of nowhere that creates amazing cars that they started off by using superior engineering and technology, and they got some money. And they built a very valuable car industry, right? Marketed towards the digitally savvy generation. So first it was expensive, but they used that money and invested money to bring the cost down. And now they're making cars that are competing with like, you know, in price to like a regular Honda Civic, in a little over a decade. And so when you look at the highly paid executives, right, they are doing well. They're blending technology with everything, right? I have a fundamental belief that you'll see Tesla manufacturing all kind of robots and things that we use right throughout our society. But what I'm saying is you have the old way of doing things, and now you got new people who are going, no, I can be an American manufacturer and make lots of money by hiring the very smart engineers who are open to the new world, and then we build something new, right? That the new generation can afford because price, you know, labor costs can be paid more to the people that are building something new because the people that are newly rich are really rich. You know what I mean? Like people that are in the new economy, like they don't need very cheap things from China. You know what I'm saying? Which was the manufacturing behemoth of the world for the last few decades because the middle class got hollowed out in the biggest consuming countries, you know, like America. Right? You could say, nah, like if we just rebuild everything, our economy, based on like this new economy, then everybody participating in a new economy can afford it, right? There'll be a period of time because not everybody's going to come along, but the ones that do come along are going to do well. And it's very similar, and it's maybe a difficult thing to think about because you got to break the way you think about the world. But if you break the way you think about the world and you think about digital as a new country, then you go, well, man, there's a potential of 8 billion people that can participate in this economy. Not everybody will, but there's like millions upon millions already doing it, right? And so those who are, and you can sell it anybody, anywhere, all at once with the internet. So then you go, well, man, a lot of these smart ones are going to like save their excess profits in Bitcoin, and they're going to be attracted to companies that are, you know, that are also deciding to save some of their profits in Bitcoin because it's going to be a superior currency. Store of value, part of the currency, to store their excess savings. Then you're going to want to invest in companies that are plugging into the digital system. So you're going to be like, oh, yeah, these manufacturers manufacturing the new robots and new ways of labor and the system all around the world are going to be interesting, right? Bitcoin miners become interesting because they solve an energy problem, right? You think about the platforms as the new, like, media or entertainment mediums, you know, the Microsoft, Facebook, TikTok, all those. You go, okay, they're going to be the way to get the word out digitally, right? And what you're going to see, from my perspective, is you're going to see all these digitally native companies, just like if you're an international corporation and you have to have, you have to deal in different treasuries to stay competitive, right? If you sell stuff in a country that has a currency that's depreciating at a high rate, fine. Like, you'll do what you need to do to sell in that country, but you will, as you get the currency, convert it into a superior currency. It used to be dollars, right? And they're still going to do it in dollars, but then the smarter ones that are tech savvy are going to convert what they don't need into Bitcoin. You know what I mean? And because once one do it, the other ones have to do it, right? It becomes a self-reinforcing cycle, because if company A and company B are both earning $1 million of profit a year that they don't need to reinvest, and then one company reinvests their profits in dollars that's deflating at 10% a year, and one reinvested in Bitcoin that's appreciating at 20% a year. I'm just making up a number, right? And then it plays out over time. Guess who Wall Street's going to give their money to? The company that has Bitcoin on the balance sheet become more heavily valued as the people who understand money upgrade their mindset to the new world, right? Right now, the new world is here, I don't have to imagine to see it. I see it clearly because it's right in front of us. It's just not fully built out, so people don't see it, right? And so that's what I call like imagining the future and factoring in a big trade, is saying, no, when I say imagine, you don't have to like make things up out of thin air. You can just reset your perspective, right? Just see clearly and neutrally what's going on and go, oh, let me build it out from here. Let me build the world out from here. And then it becomes relatively easy to allocate capital to that 10-year vision, right? Last part, a big piece of fuel that I feel like that I'm not really accounting for on purpose, but that is that only helps. What I'm looking at is, in order to keep this current system going, like when you get into the weeds of banking and you understand how banking works, banking is built off of collateral, right? And the reason why you see governments bail out so many of the big corporations whenever markets decline or whatever is because banks lend money off collateral. And if collateral drops below a certain level, they got to call the loan. Well, everybody's over leveraged. So if they call the loan, right, then the companies get into further financial trouble than what they already are. They got to lay off more people, which means they can produce less, which means the collateral goes down in value. It becomes a negative reinforcing debt cycle. And then like one person's income is another person's, or one person's loan is another person's income. So then it just disrupts the system. And so it's at a point now where since so many people are playing in the old world and there's not a lot of growth there, basically no growth there, but there's so much money borrowed, lent out against that, it's in a situation where you know the bailouts have to come, right? And it's not something new, right? This is something that countries do, right? Look at older companies, older industries, the farm, you know, old school farmers with all these subsidies. You look at Boeing, which got bailed out multiple times. The banks got bailed out multiple times. It's just what we do, right, to protect, you know, companies that are sustainable to the economy. And so you go, yeah, this is just going to continue. Like Japan's been doing it for the last 30 years, their economy. Like this is just the way of how countries do when they get over indebted. So like what that does, and I call it a Ponzi scheme, again, not in a negative way, but it's like in order to keep that old system going as like a foundation, which they must do, I'm in agreement with it. Because if they didn't, it would be crazy chaos in the streets. They have to continue to print money to pad up the system. But what happens is the middle class and the poor are going to take the money and spend it, right? I think there's going to, like, printing money is, yeah, like, loaning out more money. But also printing money is probably going to be like what we did in 2020, where there's just money given out, whether it's, we can do an episode of different ways. But what I'm saying is, like, the poor and middle class are probably going to spend it, right, by nature of not being very financially literate. And that does what it does. But the rich are going to, like, take the free money that they're given and or the cheaper lending, and they're going to buy the scarce assets I was telling you about and the productive assets I was telling you about. And so that is why I'm educating so many people on it, is I'm saying, here's how the system works, right? The flow of money is going to come, whether it's cheaper borrowing, whether it's, you know, money coming every single month, right? And you as an investor has a choice, right? You can like if it were me, this is why I started with the budgeting thing. I would think about like, how do I reduce my lifestyle expenses? If I'm not investing as much as I want to invest into, and then I would like begin to like buy assets in the future, or buy assets that are built in the future, right? And as the government begins to unlock and print more money, right, take that money and channel it to the future. And then get crazily wealthy over time, because like the scale that I think is going to have to happen to fix these government debts are going to be like crazy. And it might be more subtle than what you think. I'm going to do a whole episode on that, because I can go through line by line on ways they've already unlocked money and put it into the system that is not being sent. But I can also extrapolate the ways I think they're going to get more money into the system, right? And if you're aware of it, you can say, cool, thanks. Let me use it to propel my net worth. But hope this helps. Until next week, enjoy yourself.
Philip Washington Jr. is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and/or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. Past performance is not indicative of future performance.